Thank you for downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book on some area of world sport, and we interview the author. This week, my guest is Samir Chopra, professor of philosophy at Brooklyn College. Samir is a returning guest to the podcast. We last talked to him in 2013 about his book, Brave New Pitch, An Examination of the Current State of World Cricket. For this episode, we are discussing the new anthology of essays that he's posted over the last few years on the site ESPN CricInfo. The book is titled Eye on Cricket, Reflections on the Great Game. It was published in February 2015 by HarperCollins India. Samir's essays cover a wide range of topics, from memories of watching and playing the game in India to questions of nationalism and politics in cricket today. In several essays, Samir reflects on being, as he says, a cricket exile in America, and how he has become more aware of his cricket fandom as a key part of his identity in the three decades he has lived in the United States. Devoted fans of the game, as well as novices like myself, will find Samir's essays to be rich with insight, not only about cricket, but also about the role that sport in general has in shaping our lives. As we discuss in the interview, Samir's childhood experiences with cricket in India are similar to the experiences that young fans and players have with any sport in any part of the world. Here's my interview with Samir Chopra. My guest for this episode of New Books in Sports is Samir Chopra. Samir, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks for having me on. Great to be here again.
So it's been a while. It's been 2 years since you were on the podcast. We talked about your previous book, and I'll ask you, though, to say a few words to reintroduce yourself to listeners. And in particular, something that comes out of your book is that you've had something of a peripatetic life, moving not only from India to the U.S., but also with an extended stay in Australia. So could you say something of your travels, your academic interests, and how all of those stir up with your cricket interests?
So, yeah, I mean, as you noted, I was born and raised in India. I moved to the States for graduate school and became one of those unfortunate cricket fans that have to find a new home in a land that pays little or no attention to cricket. And you know, as I've often said, not only just pays very little attention to cricket, often has a kind of a very proud hostility to cricket within its cultural understandings of the game. And then yet, at the same time, while living in cricket, I've had access to this community of people who are cricketing exiles. And then in the middle, thanks to my academic work, thanks to a postdoctoral fellowship, I went off and lived in a sort of cricketing promised land. I went off and lived in Australia for a couple of years, where I was surrounded by, you know, very proud and entrenched cricketing culture, by probably the world's strongest cricketing nation, folks who like to play cricket and play it hard and seriously. And I played cricket while I was there. I played cricket for 3 seasons while I was in Australia. And I actually got a chance, which is not something that many cricket fans get, which is to enjoy a cricketing culture in another country and play there and soak up their style of playing, their language, their methods and tactics. And I enjoyed it all, you know, profoundly and deeply. And I think it's understanding my sense of cricket as a global game with, you know, playing host to many different cultures.
And I was going to ask about this later on, but I'll ask about it now. What surprised you about Australians and Australian cricket fans? Because you do have something of a rivalry between India and Australia. So was there something of a hostility? Well, I don't know, hostility, but you do have certain stereotypes about Australians. And were you surprised when you moved there?
You know, the one stereotype about Australian cricket fans that I mentioned in one of my essays in Eye on Cricket is that, you know, they're loud, they're patriotic, they drink a lot of beer, they get, you know, they turn a bright lobster red in the, you know, in the hot afternoon Australian sun. But the other thing that I found out about Australians, which is something that I already noticed when I watched telecasts from Australia, is that Australian fans are amongst the most, you know, one would say the most enthusiastic and knowledgeable in the way that they treat opposition teams. You know, when an opposition player pulls off a good play on an Australian sporting ground, he takes a beautiful catch or he has a good spell of bowling or hits a good shot, you hear loud applause from Australian sporting crowds, you know, from Australian cricketing crowds. And I think one of the reasons for that that I discovered and that I mentioned in one of my essays is that many Australians who go to see the game actually play the game themselves. Mm-hmm. So the percentage of recreational cricket players that I think you'll find in an average Australian cricketing crowd might be larger than other populations. It's entirely possible. I'm not willing to go out and make a kind of a hardcore empirical claim about this, but it seems to me that's the case. And, you know, as a result, they have some sense of the nuances of the game. They have the empathy that a fellow player has for another player. They know how difficult it is to play cricket or how difficult it is to play cricket well. So they're willing to appreciate talent when in whatever national form it might take on. And I found that rather gratifying, and I found that, you know, I found some of the conversations that used to surround me in an Australian cricketing stand to be wonderful to listen to. I've heard many good ones over the years. I've only reported a couple of them in my book. But, you know, they're the evidence of people who play the game on the weekends and who, when they go to a stadium to see people play, they're seeing people like themselves play the game at a much better level than themselves. But they're not just people who have gone there to see entertainment. You know, it's not just like I'm going to throw a few coins into the rink and come on, you know, dance for me. It's more like we've come to see people do something that we like to do as well. They just do it really better than us. And so we're willing to appreciate them and we're willing to understand them when they screw it up because we know just how hard it is.
Mm-hmm. So you had played as a kid.
Yeah.
And you had played in school and then you had this experience, you know, playing at a higher level in Australia. How has it shaped your writing about cricket to have had the experience as a player? And let me throw this out as well. Do you find that is it more common among cricket writers that they've played the game?
I'm not sure. I think when I read I think when I read players write in the game, I do find that a certain kind of technical insight that players have is more acute than that of journalists.
Yeah.
On the other hand, players have a certain kind of blindness to the other facets of the game that I think experienced writers and journalists are you know, able to bring out more. In my own personal case, I found that I had a certain understanding of the game when I played till high school, where I'd just largely just been playing a lot of pickup games and, you know, playing in parks and things like that. And then at the college level, I played on a slightly more organized basis. I mean, I was never a very good player. I mean, I was never a good player, period. I was always a pretty terrible player. But I think just even playing cricket on proper pitches, playing with some more equipment, playing with a proper organized team, I think that itself started to affect my understanding of the game. I think in the last 3 years that I spent in India, between 1984 to 87, I'd started playing cricket a little bit more seriously. Mm-hmm. And I think those 3 years, I mean, partly it was just I was growing up. You know, I was transitioning between the ages of 17 to 20 and becoming an older person and a more mature person. You know, I was also playing the game more and I found my appreciation of the game enhanced. I think I give the example in IIF cricket. One summer I played tennis all summer long with my wife at the local parks, and we used to walk down there every morning and we used to play this, you know, these ridiculous sort of tip, lob and run games that most beginner tennis players play. And even just playing that, I started to watch tennis players differently. I mean, backhands are difficult. Backhands are really, really difficult. And you need to crouch down low when you make them to sort of get your weight right. And I watched tennis players doing this and they do it really well. And, you know, the way they keep their eyes on the ball. And I suddenly realized, wow, these guys are doing something which I am happy to watch because I feel like I'm part of the process and the activity with which they're concerning themselves. And now I am like them. Mm-hmm. You know, we pick up the same racket and the same ball. They just do it much better than I do. Mm-hmm. And I started watching more tennis. I actually started watching humble ATP tour games, which I never used to pay attention to. I was always like grand slams. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I started watching Saturday night games and, you know, there's some quarterfinal going on somewhere because now you're just watching players and you're watching it because you're watching You're just watching a game that you want to watch. I think it's the same thing with like serious baseball fans. You know, it's like I walk back along these grounds next to Prospect Park, and you know, there's a youth league that plays there on the weekends. And you'll see it. People will just go stand behind the, you know, they'll go stand behind the banner. And I love it. I'll go stand behind the banner and I'll just watch a pitcher. And, you know, he's just some 17-year-old kid who's, you know, who's sending down heat. And, you know, you're watching this guy and you're like, it's great to watch. It's just like, it doesn't matter if it's not, you know, the Mariners versus the Yankees. It's just baseball.
Yeah.
And I think that tends to come to people who are players. I think that tends to come to people who have played the game. Mm-hmm. Not just people who want to watch like big names and participate in a kind of a marquee cultural event, I think, you know. So let me
throw this out. I was thinking of it with both tennis and baseball, which I've played, and when I watch them, something that strikes me is occasionally you'll see top level players in those sports make the same stupid mistakes that I make.
Yeah.
And do you see that in cricket as well?
Yeah, sure. I mean, top-class cricketers will drop absolute sitters. They will bowl no balls, which honestly no top-level professional should be doing, you know, especially when they've had so many warm-ups. They have bowling coaches. They have, you know, they have all this attention to form and technique. You'll see batsmen play shots that are just like, you know, you're like, what was this guy thinking? You know, I mean, he's just, I mean, You'll see batsmen play bad shots to bad balls and just get out and, you know, at like crucial times. And all you can say is, well, I guess that was a rush of blood to the head. You know, there's no other way to make sense of this. And that reminds you, you know, people are mortals. They have, you know, they have lapses of judgment. You know, we all have these irrational parts of our brain that convince us it's sensible to try something really stupid. And I think you notice that and you say, yeah, I can, you know, I get that.
Yeah.
You know, I know why he might have done it. So
we should talk about your book. Your book, Eye on Cricket, is a compilation of your essays that you wrote for The Cordon at ESPN Crick Info. And this is something
reworked and rewritten, I should point out.
Okay. Yeah. So I was going to say, though, this is something as an academic philosopher. It's not likely that you would ever be called upon to publish your greatest hits in academic philosophy. So this experience of going back through your writing, was it difficult? Was it enjoyable to go back through your posts and select those for publication and work on them?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. When I first wrote these posts, they started off as, you know, 500, 600 word little posts that were sort of, you know, near the top of my head, little thoughts that would run through my head, things I wanted to comment on, remark on. And when I wrote them down, I thought even as I wrote them that these are pointers to future opportunities to go back and revisit them. I always thought of them as kind of scratches on the surface of something that I wanted to explore a little further. And I have to admit that shortly after I started blogging at ESPN in 2008, I had started to think about putting together a collection of these at some point. And as the essays went on and as the posts went on, as they grew in number, you know, my desire to do that grew. And after Brave New Pitch came out in 2011, I talked to the folks at HarperCollins and I asked them if they would like to do this collection. And my editor said, sure. And, you know, initially I had suggested a larger collection. I think I'd suggested maybe taking, you know, something like 50 of the posts and publishing that collection. And my editor suggested we do something shorter, and that was fine. So it actually made my selection a little bit more selective, so to speak. So when I went back through the collection, I looked for pieces that I thought would be timeless, you know, to kind of use a cliche, to find posts that said things that were enduring, that tapped into issues that wouldn't become too quickly dated by the time in which they were written. You know, some of the posts I wrote on ESPN Cricket Info were sort of what you might call reactions to current happenings in the cricket world, you know, sort of polemical tirades or, you know, refutations and disputations to current affairs. But some of these were the kinds of things that I wanted this book to be about, you know, reflections by a fan looking back over his playing experience and the various facets of the game that had, you know, that had enthralled me over the years. And so I think that was kind of interesting. And then grouping the essays was kind of interesting. I found they fell into certain categories, but not all the categories are not all the essays sit comfortably within the categories. And I think that's a good thing because it shows that the range of interest that these essays span is actually quite broad. Mm-hmm. So the lack of fit in a way within the categories is actually probably a good thing because it shows that you have a bunch of different issues floating around out here. And then I enjoyed going back and actually expanding them, reworking them. I changed some of the language. I sometimes combined a couple of the posts. Sometimes I found that there were things I'd said before that I didn't want to say anymore. I was happy because I finally got a chance to show that somebody might have thought that the blog posts were just a bunch of, you know, disparate little entities mm-hmm. scattered all over the place. But in a way, I think in this book, they've sort of come together into a kind of a totality, which makes them hang together in a way as well.
So did you see in your own writing over the years, were you surprised by, or did you always know that there was a consistency of thought, that there are some common threads running through your essays over the years?
I think the common thread in my essays, I tend to spend a lot of time talking about the personal impact that cricket has on me, mm-hmm. you know, the effect it has on my emotions and on my understanding of the world and my place within it. I am not so much of, you know, I think Brave New Pitch was me talking about the game and its socioeconomic context. And that was a kind of a switch for me. I hadn't thought in that way about cricket before in terms of this, you know, cricket's financial place and stuff like that. And I think in Eye on Cricket, I've kind of returned to my older self, which is, you know, perhaps even a more sentimental and nostalgic mm-hmm. me, you know, one who spent so much time away from India, thinking about the way I experienced cricket back in those days. I actually ran into an old high school friend of mine who said, you know, Samir, you've written 3 books on cricket. I had no idea you were such a cricket fan, you know, when I knew you in high school. I said, you know, in those days, we were just all cricket fans. We were all cricket fans. We were all in high school. We were all watching the game. We didn't make such a big deal about our cricket fandom because mm-hmm. we were in the middle of a cricketing culture. Mm-hmm. But then when I left and I found myself in the States, I realized, wow, I'm a kind of a singularity out here. I left behind this whole part of my life. And then so it's also a lot of it is looking back upon the game from this distance. So I'm sure there's all in this game, there are in this book, there are all the distortions that like nostalgia introduces, mm-hmm. You know, that sort of gauzy haze that the, you know, that the nostalgic lens imposes upon us. I'm sure it's like present in this, in these essays, but I don't think it's swamped the book with sentimentalism. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's done that. So I'm kind of happy with the fact that it's, that these reflections are personal, but I like to think they're not mawkish.
And I want to turn to the first section, which deals with your childhood as both a player of cricket as well as a fan. And this was, you know, both with your blog entries on your childhood days of playing the game as well as including them in the book. This is something I would say of a bold step. Like you say, you don't want to be mawkish. And I think a lot of readers could take it that way. But you do it regularly. You include these essays in your book. And why was it important to say something about your childhood experiences with the game?
I think one is the most obvious one because the childhood exposures to the game are quite honestly, you know, they're the foundation and they are the ones that brand you emotionally. I think if there are the deepest wellsprings of my responses to cricket lie in those early exposures. The fact that my father played cricket, the fact that my uncles were so passionate about cricket, the fact that you couldn't separate winter and the festivals and the light and the sounds from the sound of cricket commentary on the radio. And so I know that if there is a way that I respond to cricket now, that if the way there's a cricket that affects me, it's because of those experiences. So I can't make sense of myself as a cricket fan and the place it has in my life without processing those experiences. So I knew I was going to return to those. And, you know, it's like some folks will say they learned about they learned about geography and history by reading Tintin. Well, I learned a lot of geography and history and politics by reading about cricket. Mm-hmm. You know, why is cricket played in South Africa? Why is cricket played in different parts of the world? How did it get there? Why do cricket rivalries and fans have the particular dimensions and the contours that they do? Why are certain nations in rivalry to each other? And cricket served as a kind of a jumping off point for exploring these broader issues. And it kind of fueled a sense of inquisitiveness about the world. And I would, you know, I would read books about cricket being played in distant parts of the world. And I thought about those distant parts of the world. I wanted to go there. I wanted to see what they were like. I love traveling. And I'm honest. I think like one of the reasons why I love traveling so much is because I read books as a child about, you know, about cricket and, you know, even sadly the world wars or, you know, wildlife, you know, they made me want to go to these places where these things happened. I mean, you know, they would tell me about Cape Town, you know, beautiful Newlands at Cape Town, you know, with this, you know, with Tabletop Mountain, this beautiful mountain that like overlooks the cricket ground, one of the most beautiful cricket grounds in the world. And I was like, my God, I want to go to this ground. Where is this place? Where is this place where these people sit in the stands and they speak these different languages and they have this different style of playing the game? So in some ways, if there is this way that I am, it's because of cricket and, you know, with these other things. So to speak of the place of cricket in my life without exploring its childhood dimensions, you know, would have to be an incomplete, mm-hmm. you know, would be to leave something unsaid or something incomplete in that sense. Mm-hmm. And as you can tell just by my reactions, you know, it's a deeply moving thing for me as well, to be even think about, you know, the role it had in my childhood at that time. And of course, you know, it's locked up in memories of my father who's not with me anymore, and you know, people and places you know, that I've left behind.
Yeah. Well, that was what I was going to ask. So you were just talking about how reading about cricket and following cricket as a child kind of put in the spark of you wanted to see the world. And yet in those opening essays where you write about your childhood in India, it's remarkably, remarkably vivid writing about India. And yeah. So I was wondering, you know, how much of it is exploring not only the roots of cricket in your life, but trying to recapture something of home for you?
Yeah, I think I said at one point in, I think if not in the essays in Iron Cricket, but in another book that I just sent off to the publishers, that I would bring back videos of cricket matches from India when I would travel, and I would bring them back to the States, and I would bring them back ostensibly to watch cricket, mm-hmm. but also because by watching cricket, I would be watching cricket in India.
Oh, okay.
So I would see the stands behind, and I would see the people in the stands. And, you know, when I would see cricket matches being played in Delhi, I would see the sunlight the way it was in Delhi in the winters, and that, you know, and that haze that back in the day in Delhi did not speak of the kind of, you know, terrible pollution that's now infected our, you know, the India's capital. But, you know, there was a little sort of light fog and mist that used to obscure the mornings in Delhi. You could see the skylines of the buildings behind. And it was a way of experiencing not just the game, but that which lay around and sort of behind the game as well. And obviously, you know, following the game out here as well meant following it in the company of other cricket fans, many of whom were Indians. So you would get a chance to talk to them about your understanding of the game and the place that the game had in your lives. So, you know, you left one community behind of cricket fans, but then you found a new one here. Mm-hmm. And like the new community of cricket fans out here had its own camaraderie, its own fraternity, its own fellowship, because we all had a loss or a kind of a privation in common. We were in this self-imposed exile, and we were all infected by this spirit of longing. And, you know, we all knew we were together in wanting to be part of this, of the sensation of following this game that we all loved so much.
Mm-hmm. You do take on in one of your essays the stereotypes about cricketers from mm-hmm. different countries, or more broadly from the East and the West. And so as someone from India who's lived in Australia and now lives in the States, do you see more of those kinds of stereotypes about playing styles associated with particular national background or broad cultural background in cricket than you do in other sports?
I don't know if it's more pronounced, but I do think there's a certain species of exoticizing in cricket writing that's never gone away.
Okay.
It was far more pronounced. It was, you know, perhaps more overt in the cricket writing in the olden days. There's an essay I wrote on Cricinfo a few months ago, or maybe last year, where I pointed out a couple of examples of writing from the 1930s and 1940s, mm-hmm. which are like, you know, just like unbelievably orientalist in their style and inclination. But I think the old stereotypes are still pretty much in place. You know, cricketers from South Asia, that is Pakistan, India, and Sri Lanka and Bangladesh are... I think if someone was to do a sophisticated text analysis of the writings on these players, mm-hmm. you would find certain adjectives would show up in big clusters. You know, they're stylish, they're wristy, they are graceful, they're lissom, they are, you know, they're gentle almost. Mm-hmm. They're sort of, they are creatures that are light, they are frivolous, they are carefree. They're not as serious as, you know, as the Anglo-Saxon cricketers are, you know, who are hard-bitten, who have a sort of tougher sensibility. You know, cricketers from the Caribbean similarly are temperamentally weaker. And, you know, that used to be the old stereotype attached with Caribbean cricketers in the old days that, you know, they're calypso cricketers. They're carefree. They are, you know, winning or losing is all the same for them. You know, they play to enjoy the game, not necessarily to win the game, and so on and so forth. I don't think that has gone away in cricket writing. And I think there is far too much dubious social science theorizing about the attitudes and inclinations of South Asian players or you know, Caribbean players and things like that. I'm not sure that has gone away. And I think I've kind of put that out in one of the essays, you know, the essay that you're alluding to, which is that it's an all too easy fitting into categories that I don't think does justice to the kind of diversity of playing styles and inclinations that you actually have across cricketing cultures. Obviously, there are some broad categorizations that one could make, but I don't think they capture the richness mm-hmm. of cricket. And I think it lands up diminishing people's cricketing abilities and, it lands up giving us a misleading impression of why people lost games or why they won games for that matter, you know. It leads to also kind of a facile moralizing about people's virtues and dispositions and temperaments, which I find quite, you know, at best, mildly off-putting and amusing, and at worst, kind of reductive and, diminishing in some ways of the hard work that people put in and the kinds of efforts that people make to master this quite mm-hmm. difficult game.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do have to ask you, I know that you're progressive in your politics. In fact, you were arrested at a demonstration last year. But in many of your cricket opinions, you can mm-hmm. be quite conservative. In fact, you called yourself at one point something of an oldie. So, do you find that there's your cricketing opinions are something of a separate sphere from your political opinions, or where do you see cross pollination, so to speak?
Two facets to that response. I think one is being conservative about the direction of the game, mm-hmm. you know, should we change the rules? Should we morph the game into different versions? Should we play the game differently? And there's one important regard in which I am conservative, which is that I don't like tinkering with the rules of the game excessively, which is very, very common in the limited overs versions of the games. And I think that the tinkering with the rules of the game is largely done in one direction, which is that of modifying the balance between bat and ball, which I don't think has been great for the game. And also tinkering with the rules of the game, in my understanding, tends to show a lack of respect for the fans, because it's like, you know, the fans are just too stupid to mm-hmm. get along with the older version of the game, and they're not going to understand the game, and they're not going to appreciate the game. So let's just modify it. And I don't think there's any need for that. I think fans will appreciate the game for what it is without these tinkerings. So I think in that sense, I am perfectly happy to be a conservative when it comes to tinkering with the rules of the game. I am a progressive in the sense that I would like to see some changes in the game made that have to do with, I would be happy to see more franchise-based cricket, especially if it had a place for longer forms of the game. I would like to see some of the power of the national boards reduced. I would like to see a lot of reform in cricket when it comes to labor relations. You know, this is all things that I talked about in Brave New Pitch. I would like to see, in that sense, I think I'm a progressive, and in ways that sometimes, you know, people who are older fans of the games think that I'm, you know, suggesting too many changes or being unrealistic in the kind of change that I think is possible in cricket. There's another way in which to think about being a conservative or a progressive in cricket is whether you are conservative or progressive as far as your tolerance of other fans on the game goes. You know, are you, do you rely on national stereotypes when you talk about fans from other parts of the world? And I think that I don't touch on so much in this book, but I think that will come up in my next book, which is, you know, where I talk about my understanding of the game's politics and my understanding of the, of say, Pakistani cricket fans and, you know, Pakistan as a cricket nation, or even the Anglo-Australian sort of the Anglo-Australian axis, as I like to call it. And that you might be someone who is very progressive in his politics, and yet you find yourself suddenly in your unguarded moments saying things that are not so cool politically when it comes to fans from other, you know, you suddenly find yourself revealing perhaps some quasi xenophobic prejudice or some kind of cultural prejudice. And I've been guilty of that in my own ways. I've been guilty of that when I was a youngster, and I've been guilty of that when I was, and I'm an older person. In fact, I don't know if you remember this, but when we did that radio broadcast with Iago and with Amy, I said actually that I think for many sports fans, sports is the domain within which we let ourselves be slightly xenophobic, nationalist, bigoted people. You know, we are
With the idea, with the qualifier, oh, it's just sports. So
it's just sports, or you know, it's okay to say things about fans from other countries. So long as you're talking about it in the context of sports. Oh, you know how Spanish fans are, or you know how German fans are, or, you know, German soccer is like this. And, you know, that's the domain within which you let yourselves do this, whereas you wouldn't allow yourself to do that in other spheres of life. And that might be another way in which the progressive by day reveals himself to be a not-so-progressive by night or by some other time of the day when he's watching sport. And so I think there are these two dimensions. You know, one is politically conservative, or, you know, one is sportingly conservative, or one is or how much reliant one is on the same kinds of stereotypes that one finds problematic in our political world, but we trade on them when it comes to tracking our sports.
All right. So at the start of the interview, Samir, you talked about being a cricket exile in America, this land where I think you said where there's a proud hostility to cricket. And you do have one of your essays is about talking cricket with Americans. And I'll ask, have you ever been able to convert a native-born American to an appreciation of cricket?
I've never been able to convert a native-born American to an appreciation of cricket, but I think I've managed to get a couple of native-born Americans interested in cricket and perhaps just a little bit appreciative of a couple of dimensions of cricket. And I think there is a common thread to these folks. They are typically interested in world sport in general. They are interested in games that are not played in America. So all of these folks are interested in soccer, for instance. Also, I think just about every one of them has been interested in baseball. So I think there's a curiosity about a game that maybe looks like baseball and how is it done out there. So you can start to mention some of the dimensions of the game which are similar and, you know, start to maybe make them take a closer look at cricket to see how it's done. The day the World Cup final was played, I had some friends over to my place to celebrate my birthday, which had taken place a few days earlier. So some friends were over, we were hanging out, and this was not a World Cup final party. It was just that the World Cup was going to begin the same night. So as the party was winding down, the game started. And in fact, I didn't want people around me when the final started because I wanted people to leave. And I was like, you know, I don't want to watch the final with people watching the game with me who don't know anything about the game, who are not going to appreciate it, and who are just going to give me a hard time about the game. But anyway, you know, the game came on and some folks were there. And at least a couple of the people who were there with me you know, sat there and they paid attention. And, you know, it was the World Cup final. So there's the whole razzle-dazzle of a major sporting event. It's a large screen television. You're seeing the best of the best playing the game in front of you. And it's not, and they're not watching cricket because it's part of, you know, the commercial for some airline for the Caribbean, or, you know, part of a, you know, some ridiculous photograph and, you know, that's taken, you know, of a bunch of people playing cricket in some park where the game looks very different from its international, from its international version. So now they're seeing the top level version of the game and they're able to see something which they might not have paid attention to before. And I saw a kind of an intrigue and an interest there, which I had not seen before. So I think that's about the closest that I've come to it. I've had a couple of friends say things like, we should watch a game together, or let me know if there's some game we can watch together. And I think those are my biggest triumphs, so to speak. I've not managed to convert anybody. I've met some Americans who are cricket fans, but their conversion happened elsewhere. My church can claim no credit for those. We can't put them in our numbers for the year.
Yeah. You do make a great point though, about how key masculinity is in terms of getting Americans to appreciate the sport.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, it's there in Americans' understanding of soccer. It's there in Americans' understanding of cricket. You know, I mean, 99% of American criticism of soccer will have a role in it somewhere for they're wimpy, you know, they fall, they act like they're hurt. I mean, I could stand anything about soccer, but not this faking. They're just such wimps, or, you know, they don't meet their impression of what manly sports people should be like, or and, you know, and cricket just looks genteel, you know. The ball hardly seems to move, these guys don't hardly seem to be running. I mean, what the hell is so athletic about this game, right? And and then they wear all this protection, right? So I remember, you know, when I saw Fire in Babylon, you know, the, you know, the documentary about the West Indies, the great West Indies cricket teams of the 1980s. I remember thinking, man, Americans should see this, you know. They'll see that people can get hurt in cricket, you know. They'll see what role fear and intimidation has to play in cricket. You know, something which cricket itself struggles to reconcile itself to. That is, you know, fear and intimidation are a very vital part of the game. And last year, you know, Philip Hughes was killed by a cricket ball. And, you know, there was a lot of soul searching in the cricket game. We praise fast bowlers because they're dangerous. You know, they bring a frisson to our understanding of the game. You know, when a fast bowler aims a ball at a batsman's head and the batsman ducks, you know, there's this little buzz of excitement that goes around the ground. You know, there's something very gladiatorial about it. A lot of people know they can't play cricket beyond a certain level. Like I knew at the college level, man, this game, I think I'm done with it, because you start passing a certain level and you know you shouldn't play it beyond a certain level because you could get really hurt. Yeah. I knew players in Australia who told me they didn't want to get promoted to the next league if we won the league championship. They're like, dude, B division, there's a lot of fast bowlers out there, man. I don't want to get my head knocked off.
Yeah.
C division is good enough for me. I can handle the pace bowlers in the C division. So, mate, the bowlers in the B division, they're fast. They'll knock your head off. And, you know, you think about that. And so when Australians or so when Americans start to pay attention to those aspects of the game that have to do with, you know, oh my God, the balls come at you so hard. How do you catch them with your bare hands? Or, you know, how do you, you know, these cricket balls are really hard and, you know, you could, you know, they could actually give you a skull fracture. You think, now these guys know what we're talking about. And there's that kind of vindication that, you know, we've been vindicated on the most, you know, on in the best way possible. We've not had our masculinity questioned, you know. So there's, and I think that reaction is there in the positive reactions to the piece that I mentioned. Like, now these guys have noticed a facet of the game which they hadn't noticed before.
Yeah.
You know.
So bringing that up, I want to pick up on that last statement you had. So this is a quote from the book. This is on page 170. And as with your last book, there are just so many wonderful, wonderful, wonderful lines. You know, you have a great style, and this isn't so much for the style, but it's just an interesting point you make. Do I seek approval of cricket from Americans? I would like to think not, and consider myself secure enough to not experience that particular insecurity. Yet, when an American does appreciate cricket, I feel my love for the game validated. Could you unpack that for us, please?
Whoa, layers and layers. You know, it's, I think I, this is my home, right? I mean, America's mm-hmm. my home. And I, in some ways, I feel like an outsider and an outlier in this regard because I support a game or I follow a game and a game so consumes me, which people around me simply don't give two hoots for, right? So it's how I've chosen to exclude myself from the world around me. So when that world reaches out to me and it says that we know what makes you tick, I feel taken in, right? And I think that's the immigrant in me, or that's the person who's stranded between two cultures, finding acceptance and wanting it and taking it. There is a political angle of it that you don't want America to be the arbiter of everything. Things can be good without America finding them good. But yet America looms large in our imagination. America is America. America is, you know, you see the word America in print. It just reads differently. You know, we live in a world in which America rides large in our imagination, and it's where I live, and it's where I made a home. It's where I'm bringing up my family. It's, you know, it's so dominant in me culturally and historically and intellectually. So there are these two competing impulses within me, that of wanting acceptance by this place, and yet the political part of me pushing back on the sense that you should feel completely comfortable and secure in your relationship to cricket, and you should not need validation. It's like, you know, it's like somebody saying you should just have enough self-esteem to have this proper self-image of yourself and to not need external validation. It's that kind. But, you know, you want cricket written into the world's larger sporting culture. You want it written into the world's larger sporting, cultural, and political sensibility. And one way to have that is to have that be taken in by America as well. You know, it's you know, it's almost like saying if cricket could make it in New York, it could make it anywhere, right? You know, why New York? You would like to think, hey, you know, somebody could make it somewhere else and make it elsewhere as well. But that's how we've come to configure this imaginary space in our minds. And that's mine. You know, for someone who grew up looking at the US from afar, then found himself here, and then looks back and then thinks about how he would like this to be transplanted out here as well. I don't think cricket is ever going to become a game in the US. I don't think it's ever going to become big. I don't think it'll ever become an American game. But I just want Americans to stop hating cricket, and I just want Americans to just view it, or at least be able to see what it is that enthralls its fans. That's all. You don't necessarily want perhaps a home for the game in the way that basketball, football, and tennis have, though even a small slice would do. But you want some greater working of it into the American sensibility. It would make my place in America more secure, obviously. I would not be that much of an outsider. But I think it would be, you know, it would be America telling me, we get you because now we know why you are the way that you are, because you've understood something about the game that you love so much.
Well, we're almost out of time, Samir, and I want to finish up by asking you. So you finished your undergraduate degree in math. You were a programmer. You do philosophy of technology, artificial intelligence in terms of your academic work. But it seems to me, in reading through those essays and reading through your blog posts and reading your last book and reading a draft of your next book, that what really moves you, or what really draws you in cricket, is the beauty, is the aesthetics of cricket. Is that a correct reading?
That's a very interesting. That's a very interesting call, because I often find myself saying to people that people watch games of cricket for hours and hours on end, because they know that at certain points something is going to happen that is just going to be so beautiful that they will find that it was all worth it. And I know that's true with me, that I, like many cricket fans, grew up spending a lot of time just looking at photographs of players. And there was a way that the body was captured in those photographs that was, you know, that was, that once again becomes part of this kind of coding in your mind. And you want those parts of your brain tickled when you watch the game. And so I think one of the things that I feel lucky about as a cricket fan now is that we can watch cricket in such amazing television coverage. We have super slow-mo cameras, high-definition television, slow motion replays from 10 different angles. I mean, it's, this is like a visual feast for us.
Yet at the same time, you say in one of your essays, it's not as beautiful.
Yes, that's right. Because the appearance of the players has changed, and because of the way the game is structured. And so there's that struggle. You want those older images to be dominant. So there's that curious paradox or irony that just as our means of inspecting the game have become more refined, what's actually happening on the ground is perhaps not as beautiful because player styles have changed and player sensibilities have changed, the way they dress and the way they play the game has changed. But yes, I think I watch cricket because other than the struggle that you see between the players and the results that you want, you're also looking to see something pretty. You're looking to see the body work in a particular way. You're looking to see particular configurations of body and bat and ball. Just like sometimes when we watch soccer, you know, we are willing to put up with lots of dross because we're looking for gems. Happens in reading as well. You know, you'll wade through lots of dull books looking for, you know, the really good one, that bright sentence that will capture you. And I think I think the focus on beauty and aesthetics is interesting because that's probably true, because you know these little starts of pleasure you get when you hit that beautiful sentence or when you hit that beautiful image. And you look for it. And I remember, like, when I first saw slow motion replays in cricket, I think I said this in Brave New Pitch, that I realized, like, oh, a television reel is just thousands and millions of photographs stuck together. And when they're showing me these slow motion replays, I can sometimes see the photographs that cameras had captured. And I was like, wow, it's all there. And I remember the thrill that I got when I first saw high quality slow motion replays. I just wanted to watch them again and again because they were showing me these things that I took pleasure in, and they were letting me inspect them at greater detail than I'd ever had before. And it was one of the most thrilling sort of transitions in my understanding of the game, you know. And, you know, you mentioned the sort of the technical background and the contrast with all of this. It's interesting you should mention beauty and aesthetics, because in one of my books, which is a book on free and open source software, there's a chapter in there, mm-hmm. which is on the aesthetics of code. Mm-hmm. Which is on what makes some kinds of programs beautiful and other programs not beautiful. Because programmers talk that way, even about code. They'll say, this is a beautiful piece of code. Or, you know, that's a really beautiful algorithm. And I am interested in why people find certain things beautiful, and why is it that drive for pleasure and beauty drives us mm-hmm. to do these different things. And it even sometimes, you know, in writing, I think the pleasure that a writer gets on putting together a really good sentence is that same pleasure that I think makes us look for it elsewhere. This is why I tell my students to read a lot if they want to become good writers, because then they're honing their sensibility for what they like, and they're getting examples of good sentences, and you'll unconsciously internalize them. I tell them, trust me, read a lot of good books, you'll become a better writer just like that, because you will have subconsciously, you'll have taken it in, and it'll be there when you sit down to write a sentence. You'll have your sense of what is a good sentence and a bad sentence changed by reading these books. I think just to get back to the writing bit, I think down the line, and I think it's happening now even, I think my writing is changing. What I choose to write on is changing, and I'm writing more and more personally inflected work. The last book on cricket that you read in the draft is straight autobiography. The other works that I have in mind that I'm working on right now are almost all memoirish, you know. And it's there. Here is my life. This is how I lived it, and I have this theoretical background that allows me to, which allows me a particular lens through which to view my life and, you know, the various things within it that I found thrilling or stimulating or thought-provoking or that drove me on in other directions, whether they were, you know, intellectual or emotional or romantic or whatever it is. So that's an interesting point. There's probably the aesthetic sensibility that, you know, that drives us into all these different ventures.
You've been listening to an interview with Samir Chopra about his book, Eye on Cricket, Reflections on the Great Game, published in 2015 by HarperCollins India. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects like religion, politics, and biography. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter at New Books Sports, or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your week.